May I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The story of David and Bathsheba is a tale of the corruption of power. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm both addicted and repelled by dramas that center on the abuse of power. There's that program Billions. In fact, I had to stop watching Billions because it reveals a side to our society that I find so disturbing. Now, I know it's only TV. Most recently, I've started another saga of power and its corruptions, Succession. I'm still on season one because although I kind of dallied with it in the winter, again, I found it so disturbing, I didn't have the courage to continue. But I've gathered my loins and have ventured back. Succession, if you don't know about it, is a dynamic story of dynastic nastiness. The tantalizing question is it a fictionalized tale of Trump family nastiness, or is it a tale of Murdoch, everyday ruthless rich folk? Succession's power to addict and to disturb lies in its portrayal of the depravity that flows from the abuse of the corruption of power. And these are themes that for many of us struggling with the reality of life in 21st century America are all too close to home for comfort. Al and I have taken up the habit of watching Succession as the first thing in the evening after the PBS 6 o'clock news hour. The reason is that it's easier to sleep if we get it out of the way earlier and we can move to more benign things as bedtime nears. Now, I love a tale of rich and famous folk as much as anyone else, especially when they're couched as cautionary tales. But what challenges me about the dramas like Billions and Succession is not the dramatic portrayal of ruthless violence of those who exercise absolute power and the pathetic mimicry of the echelons cascading under them. This is not like watching Wolf Hall, which accurately portrays Henry VIII's capricious abuse of power in pre-modern England, where the distance of time can provide a buffer for the emotions. The difficulty for me with Succession is, and its ilk, is that it is the portrayal of a world that is all too recognizable as the kind of world we're currently living in. This immediacy between screen and reality provides no avenue for safe emotional escape. What I want, I get, so warns the patriarch Logan Roy. A statement expressing the ruthlessness lying at the heart of the drama. This is the statement of a man who has failed to leave behind the ruthless stage of infant development. His arrested development would be pathetic if the consequences for those around him were not so dire. It's also chilling because our present world is controlled by men, mostly men, who are made in Logan Roy's image. Their failure to leave infantile ruthlessness behind in the service of emotional development has dire consequences that none of us can escape from today. America, not to mention the growing number of ruthless dictators throughout the world, is afflicted with such persons. And today we heard the continuation of the story of David and Bathsheba. Last week we heard about David's primal infatuation with Bathsheba as she performs her evening ablutions on the roof of her house. "What I want, I get," thought David. And so he got. He had Bathsheba brought to his house where he lay with her and she conceived. Bathsheba is later to be the mother of the legendary Solomon, but for now the child of this ill-begotten encounter must die as a punishment. But the question is, a punishment for what? Lay with her is the quaint way the Deuteronomist editors record this incident. And tradition has tended to romanticize David and Bathsheba as a tale of love at first sight. David's other marriages, pay heed, evangelicals, we're not talking about a paragon of monogamy here. His other marriages were political alliances. So it is possible that this is, at least for David, a love match. After all, he ends up making an honest woman of her. Now there's a phrase. Alternatively, tradition has portrayed this story as a tale of feminine seduction. After all, if Bathsheba had exercised greater modesty, she would not have excited David's sexual passion. It's a short step from here to believing that she intentionally bathed beneath the king's window with the intention to ensnare him. But remember, however, that David has all the power and then some. This makes moot the question, could Bathsheba have come willingly? You cannot act voluntarily when you have no choice not to act. So whatever the dynamics of their encounter, and we can only speculate here, the facts on the ground indicate that this is a legal rape, defined by sexual intercourse where one party has no capacity to refuse consent. But it's not sex that's wrong here, although some may question this. It's the abuse of power that matters. Last week we heard about David's machinations to engineer Uriah the Hittite's death. Here the story takes on the quality of something of a comedy of errors. David encourages Uriah to sleep with his wife, obviously to mask the fact that David is the father of the child. But mindful of his need to maintain ritual purity before battle, Uriah avoids the trap. In the end, David resorts, through his henchman Joab, of having Uriah murdered in the line of battle. Now enter onto the scene Nathan. This is the first that we've heard about Nathan. He strides into the king's house, carrying a message from God and readily willing to speak truth to power. Although prophets are mentioned from time to time before this text, what we might term the office of the prophet arises only coterminously with the shift from tribal to monarchical government in ancient Israel. Samuel is the transitional figure of this shift, and Nathan is the first to appear in this newly enhanced prophetic role. Now remember that Israel is identified by its covenant with God. And even after the shift to monarchy, there is still only one king in Israel, and Yahweh is his name. The establishment of the monarchy creates a secondary covenant between God and the king, which lays down the lines for power sharing. David as king is essentially God's regent, overseeing the correct enforcement of the covenant between Israel and God. And like our own constitution, the covenant defined the laws of the lawful exercise of power. The king is God's regent, and the prophet becomes God's spokesman. In our terms, a kind of one-man supreme court. But the essential point for us to grasp is that Israel's covenant with God conveyed an understanding that humans live in a moral universe where consequences follow action. This is especially important in its application to the exercise of David's kingly power. David's increasingly centralized power made him vulnerable to his corruption in the exercise of his power. And he's now reached the point where, to quote a contemporary analogy, if he committed murder on Fifth Avenue, there was none to stop him. The core of Nathan's, and hence God's, accusation against David is not adultery. The David-Bathsheba story is at this point only tangential to the primary story, which is about David and Uriah. The core of the accusation Nathan cunningly crafts to entrap David in his own words is that David has offended against the moral universe, not through adultery, but through murder. For Nathan, and thus we read for God, David's actions are a criminal abuse of power for which he is called to account. In that awful moment of realization, David is reduced to the confession of his sin. David is no Donald Trump or Rupert Murdoch. A later story illustrates this point. Children, you're competing with me. Elijah, in a later story, we have this interesting example of why David is not like Donald Trump or Rupert Murdoch. Because in the later story, King Ahab, you know, the husband of the infamous Jezebel, for a similar abuse of power in the murder of Naboth for the purpose of confiscating his vineyard, when confronted by Elijah, Ahab responds, "Ah, so you have found me, my enemy." A truly Trumpian response and worthy of Succession's legendary Logan Roy. The story of David is the story of greatness, but his greatness does not reside in his absolute power. It resides in six words. I have sinned against the Lord. Words that establish the correct lines of power sharing between king and God. Nevertheless, in Israel's moral universe, consequences follow action. Nathan declares that David has now set in motion a chain of violence that will never leave him nor his house in peace. And we will learn more of that in due course. But the question is, what kind of moral universe does contemporary America live in? I wonder. When will we see that personal consequences follow political actions? When will the powerful be confronted by their deeds and brought to the realization that their ruthlessness is a sin against God? When? Amen.